Welcome to the What Dreamers Do podcast. I'm your host, Carla Gover, an Appalachian musician, flatfoot dancer, mama, creative, and dreamer from Kentucky. I'm on a mission to inspire others to realize their dreams and live their most creative lives. Grab you a mason jar full of sweet tea or something a little stronger and pull up a chair, because it's time to get your dream on. Who's been following you? Because that's what dreamers do. Hello there, dreamers. I'm so happy to be with you for this week's episode of the What Dreamers Do podcast. And this week, I'm going to be talking about a subject that is very near and dear to my heart, but that I have not spoken out on very much because it's kind of sensitive and I'm a little bit scared to share this topic and to talk about my views and ideas. But I'm going to talk about it anyway because I feel like it's important and I feel like it's part of my job as a musician and a cultural educator from Appalachia and from Kentucky to talk about the issues that affect us and the ways that media representation of us make us feel, and sometimes the behavior of people who are attempting to explain or perform our culture can affect those of us who grew up here. So, welcome to the My Culture Is Not Your Costume Appalachia edition. But before we get started, there are a few things that I want to say and a few acknowledgments that I want to make because I feel that they're also important. So the first thing that I want to say is where I'm coming from is music is for everyone. Appalachian music is for everyone. I want everybody to participate in old-time music jams and flatfoot dancing and sing-alongs. And I want everybody who loves to perform it professionally or in an amateur way or just enjoy it in their homes to participate fully, no matter where they're from, no matter what their background. It's something that I love to share and I believe deeply in sharing it. So that's my first foundation that I want to tell you. I also would like to acknowledge and just touch upon the fact that our Appalachian heritage is quite diverse, both ethnically and racially, and sometimes our history has been whitewashed. There are plenty of scholars and academics who at different points in history have tried to present Appalachian culture and music as some sort of last bastion of our pure Anglo ancestry, including the very famous ballad collector Cecil Sharp. And as we know, hopefully we all know now, that's just false. It's really false. And there's been a great deal of scholarship devoted to debunking that. And anybody from Appalachia can tell you it's a more diverse place than we're sometimes portrayed as. But as an educator, as somebody who presents traditions that were heavily influenced, for instance, by African-American musicians and dancers all throughout their inception, I just feel that it's important to mention that and to acknowledge that. The final foundational thing that I want to say is a little bit more complex, because one of the things that I'm going to be talking about during this episode is cultural appropriation and how it applies to Appalachia. And I just want to acknowledge that there are other marginalized groups who deal with stereotypes and cultural appropriation who are not white, who are dealing with intersectional kinds of biases and systemic prejudice and racism. So I want to acknowledge, even as I talk about this subject that is kind of a tender spot for me, that I do have the privilege of being a straight, white, able-bodied, slim, cisgendered, heterosexual woman. And it's different. It's just different than my friends of color who are dealing with some of the same issues of representation and cultural appropriation, who also have other intersectional identities that they're dealing with. And I want to lead off with the assertion that Appalachian culture, especially when it comes to sharing the music, sharing the dance in the ways that it was shared with me in all of the communities that I grew up in, is pretty much the opposite of elitist. There was never any level that I encountered of exclusivity, elitism, you're playing that wrong, this style of music doesn't have those parameters, we play it this way. There was none of that. And anytime I've encountered that, it's been from somebody playing the music from outside the region or doing the dance from outside the region. So I just want to say and state for the record before I dive in that I'm not coming from an elitist place. The Appalachian elders from whom I have learned so much were not coming from an elitist place. I'm coming from the place of this is part of how I take back the narrative as an Appalachian, as a Kentuckian, and hopefully how I give you some food for thought as you have your own relationship with the music, whether you live back in a holler or whether you live in Brooklyn. I don't care. I just want us to all respect each other and enjoy the music together. So let's get started with what I want to talk about. I've been performing traditional Appalachian music and dance professionally ever since I left college, since I graduated from college at the age of 21. And I've seen a lot of acts. I've met a lot of people, especially in the early aughts after the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou movie came out. There was a huge wave of people playing traditional Appalachian music, forming old-time bands, and they were from all over the world and all over the country. And I was touring and probably playing about 200 dates a year at that time of my life. So I saw a lot. I met a lot of people. And some of it just really rubbed me the wrong way, and I want to talk about it. So thank you for listening along. And I think the bottom line of what I've seen that to me seems problematic is not people who are from elsewhere or from other cultures who perform Appalachian music. That's totally wonderful. There's some amazing musicians who might be from New York or California who are excellent musicians in this style, and I have tremendous respect and love for them. For me, the issue comes into play when people are performing their idea of Appalachian culture. And while I acknowledge that when you're on stage, there's always a certain question mark between what am I doing that's my authentic self and what am I doing that's a larger than life version of myself, that's normal and that's part of being on stage. But I'm just going to list for you some of the things that I've seen over the years and I'm still seeing, unfortunately. If these things had disappeared, if I did not still see these things in my travels and in watching others perform and seeing press kits and websites, then I wouldn't be needing to do this podcast. This wouldn't be an issue anymore. So, number one, fake accents. Okay, this one to me should be a no-brainer. I mean, if you're performing Appalachian music, that's awesome. And even if you're singing it in sort of the style that you learned it from whatever family you learned it from or recording, yeah, your voice might take on a little bit of that accent. But when you actually adopt some sort of your version of a Southern or Mountain accent, often one that sounds kind of fake to the ears of those of us that grew up here, it just seems odd. It seems like it's going a little too far. And for those of us that grew up getting made fun of by our Indiana cousins for the way we said night or knife or something like that, it just seems kind of like maybe you're making fun. I don't know. So fake accents, that's one. Number two, when you're trying to write songs in the style of Appalachian music, and all you write about are the old tropes of killing people, addiction, pills, spouse abuse, moonshine, poverty, violence, all those things. I'm not saying that you can't write good songs that include any of those elements, because songwriting is such a powerful way to address social issues. I do it. My band does it. I'm totally for that. I totally believe in that. But when you are, shall I say, strip mining a culture's, not just a culture's characteristics, but a culture's stereotypes so that you can write songs that you feel are more quote unquote authentic, I think that's problematic. So next, this one is a little less common, but as somebody who books bands and who has been on both ends of the spectrum from running festivals to performing at lots of festivals, I'm sending in my press kit to people. I'm reading people's bios and press kits. If you lived and or live and or work in Appalachia and have learned a lot of your material from Appalachian people, I think it's totally valid and legit that you would want to put that in your press kit. But don't write your press kit in such a way that it obscures where you're actually from and it seems like you're trying to say that you're something that you're not. It just seems kind of bogus. I mean, I guess you're not hurting anybody, but again, why not just talk about who you are and where you're from and where you learned the things you learned and where you live now and why you live there and why you love it. There's so much you can talk about without misrepresenting yourself in a way that seems designed to try to act like you're something that you're not. Another issue I have are festival presenters and promoters who seem to be picking people that are portraying that more stereotypical version of Appalachian culture because maybe they think it's what their audience wants, the people that yuck it up, the people that make hillbilly jokes on stage. And I've seen major bands do this. There was a major band, I don't know if I should call them out or not, that made a joke when they were playing in Louisville, Kentucky, about toothless people in the next county. And it was clearly intended to be a hillbilly joke, but I'm thinking you are literally making your living on quote unquote hillbilly music and dressing up in your overalls, and you're still going to make that joke. I don't know. It just, and they weren't from the region. I mean, you're a great musician. You don't need to make that kind of joke. Make a different joke. Come on. It's the 21st century, people. Another issue that I've seen, and especially during this pandemic time when people are putting on virtual festivals and you could literally hire somebody from anywhere in the world, is presenters and promoters who present Appalachian music and bands that are playing that traditional Appalachian style without any attempt to actually include one or two people that are from the region. I believe that one special thing about hiring performers who are from the tradition that they're sharing is that we have a different set of cultural contexts to the songs that we're talking about. And we have stories that go with it. In so many cases, we're telling stories about our buddies, our grandparents, our parents, our family reunions, how we worked, how we learned the song from our uncle when we were stripping tobacco, or how this was a coal mining song that was used in our county to help unionize the miners. And that's part of what makes Appalachian music so special, is it comes from this rich culture. And so when you have an artist who is from here sharing the music, they're not just sharing the music, they're sharing their whole culture, their stories. And so I believe it's very valuable and helpful to try to include some Appalachian representation in your lineup. Have your artists that are from everywhere, have your talented and light-filled and loving and beautiful artists from all over that just love fiddle tunes and banjo tunes, but include some Appalachians in the mix. Another thing that can be problematic is the way people sometimes presume to offer cultural explanations and perhaps even paint entire cultural phenomena with really broad brushes and speak on our behalf. Obviously, Appalachia is a pretty big region, and we have a lot of different groups and different kinds of people and different subcultures within the larger culture. And so there are many, many stories to tell. However, for example, one time I saw this performing group that was putting on a piece in Tennessee, and I saw it online, and I was reading the description. I think they were doing a streaming version of it too, and I was considering watching it. And then part of the show description said, This piece explores the light and darkness in Appalachian culture. And I knew some of the performers and I looked at the bios for all of them and none of them were from there. And I felt like that's a pretty presumptuous artistic thing to do when you're not from somewhere to explain or analyze or present concerning the light and darkness in a region. I mean, I'm just trying to think of a similar comparison. You know, if I went to Ecuador and studied the music and lived there for a few years, and then I created a presentation that I put on down there about the light and darkness in Ecuadorian culture. I don't know. It just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. What do you think? I'd love to hear some of your opinions about this because I know I've got some sharp cookies listening in because you send me messages and I know you're out there. So I'd love to have a dialogue about this. I'd love to hear more about your opinions and your experiences. And maybe even we'll have another episode where I share some of those. So by all means, Carla at CarlaGover.com, or you can message me on Instagram at Kentucky Carla, or reach me via Facebook Messenger at Carla Gover Music. Anyway, I just have one more item in the things that rub me the wrong way category before we move on. But this one is a big one. It's definitely not unique to me. Pretty much every creative artist, activist, buddy I have in Kentucky and in much of Appalachia shares this frustration with me, which is that film and book industries, mass media wants to promote artistic work that reinforces the same old stereotypes and the same old tropes over the more nuanced voices and descriptions and explanations of those of us who are actually from here. I am certainly not the only one saying this. There are many eloquent writers who have written about this issue and this problem far better than I have. And some of them are even going to be guests on upcoming podcasts. But for now, I'll just leave it at that. It's an ongoing issue, and it has been since the 1800s when the local color literature was very popular in the national imagination, and people wrote these very overly romanticized but also overly stereotyped books about the quaint Appalachian people, our contemporary ancestors. So anyway, I won't go into that any further at this moment. So some of these things that I'm talking about have to be changed in the media. They have to be changed on the national level, in the collective consciousness, in the New York Times, in Netflix, in the publishing industry. Some of these changes have to come by practitioners of Appalachian music that aren't from here. And maybe that's as simple as just having the awareness that this music is sacred to us and it's part of our identity.
Well, the Stanley Brothers advertise for Martha White Flour, so I'm going to do a sort of cooking advertisement here to support this podcast. I have a confession to make. I love to cook from scratch, but many nights these days, I'm only cooking for my son and myself. When I'm busy and tired, sometimes it's a little bit too easy to get takeout, so I decided to try some of those meal kit boxes that I saw advertised, and I went through four different ones until I found the one that I like best, Home Chef. Every week, I get to pick four meals that I think my family would like, and they send the ingredients right to my door. This isn't processed food either. It's just healthy meats, fresh vegetables, and grains that I prepare. It usually takes me 30 minutes or less to get supper on the table, and my picky son loves every meal. Plus, it's way cheaper than takeout. If you want to try it out, just go to carlagover.com/supper. I don't get paid for this endorsement. I just truly like the product. And if you sign up using my link, they will send me credits toward my own boxes. And with an almost 13-year-old boy in the house, I could use them. Plus, all that good food is going to help me keep recording this podcast for you. Just do me a favor and don't tell Granny.
And all we're asking for is respect. Respect. It boils down to respect. And I think that's what everybody wants. But where I think the deepest change needs to happen, and the change that I have worked the hardest to bring into effect, is within the hearts and minds of those of us who are from here, those of us who live here, and our young people especially, because so many of us have internalized the stories that we've been told about ourselves, just as we as women have internalized negative stories and we have misogyny to root out, just as people of color have internalized stories that are racist against themselves, just as those of us who are attempting to be anti-racist white people have internalized racist stories and we have to eliminate our own inner racism. Those of us who are from Kentucky, who are from Appalachia, have to constantly go through this process of evaluating, bringing awareness to, and reshaping the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. So one of those stories in my family, as an example, and I think this is a pretty commonly employed one by people that are from Eastern Kentucky, is, well, yeah, those stereotypes are true, but our people weren't like that. And of course, you know, you can look at some of the stereotypes and some of the people you see on TV and some of the photos you see. And we have seen people like that living in our hollers. You know, we did grow up next to that dude that is embarrassing our entire state on national TV. But then again, we've seen that guy in big cities too. Those problems that we have, that we're working on in Kentucky, just like everybody around the world is working on problems like addiction and poverty and education and unemployment. Of course we have those problems, but we know that they exist in every part of the world, and yet they're routinely associated and portrayed as being almost uniquely Appalachian problems. We are defined by our problems in a way that other regions are not. But I know in my family, that's one of the ways that my mother in particular dealt with the internalized stories about what hillbillies were like. Another example for her is that she went to a settlement school growing up, which settlement schools, Pine Mountain Settlement School, Hyman Settlement School, Oneida Baptist School, which is still in existence but was originally a settlement school, were often run by people who moved to Appalachia from elsewhere. And they did a lot of wonderful things on the one hand, but on the other hand, there was sometimes a narrative at those places that you needed to better yourself in the sense that you needed to get real culture. And that's something that my mom really internalized. So, you know, she grew up in this amazing musical family. And, you know, of course I did too. And I was just mesmerized by my grandmother and learning all the songs that she sang, and my uncles and my grandfather. But my mother at school learned this narrative that she needed to better herself and learn proper culture. So she was always trying to listen to opera and ballet. And I mean, I love ballet and I kind of like opera, depending. But my mom, she thought of that as the real culture. And what we had at home was, you know, that was just hillbilly stuff. And so that was another side effect of these stories I'm talking about, these stories that we're told and that we internalize. And so I think that's kind of the bottom line for me, is the things that people do when they're performing Appalachian culture that strike me sometimes as being insulting or insensitive or even, you know, presumptuous, they wouldn't rankle so much if we didn't have a stigma growing up here. I probably wouldn't think about them if I didn't, even when I went to grad school, you know, in 2015, have a professor that routinely would single out things that I said in my accent and point me out in front of the class, even though my accent is so much milder than it used to be. It's kind of like those of us that are from here have lived through a lot of stereotypes. We've dealt with our share of stigma and being made fun of or having things assumed about us based on where we're from. And so to see people that are performing our music also attempting to perform our culture and our identity, especially if that's in ways that are reinforcing those stereotypes or seem mocking in some way, it just feels hurtful. And it's unnecessary because you can perform Appalachian music at Carnegie Hall and not be from Appalachia and do a brilliant, amazing job and still be respectful and culturally sensitive to the people that you learn the music from or the culture that you learn the music from. So those of us from Kentucky who play traditional music and perform traditional dance, it's more than just music. It's more than just dance. It's who we are, and it's our communities, and it's our families, and it's precious to us. It's one of our most precious natural resources besides the people themselves that live here. So, and I think like any other group of people or any other individual anywhere in the world, we just want respect and we want appreciation for the beautiful qualities that our culture has. And I think one final thing that really is worth mentioning in this discussion is you can't really have a conversation about Appalachian culture and the problems that we face in Appalachia. And I say problems because that's usually what people want to talk about when they talk about our region. When reporters come here, when people actually don't even come here and write articles about us in the New York Times, what they want to talk about is, what's wrong with these people? Why are they like this? Why are they so backwards? Why are they living this way? And I've said it before and I'll say it again. If we're going to have that conversation, we have to talk about the centuries of economic injustice and oppression that have occurred due to an extractive industry that has benefited the rest of the United States at times at the expense of Appalachian people, and has certainly lined the pockets of corporations, industries, and individuals primarily not from the region. When I was growing up, 80% of the mineral rights and about 60% of the land were owned by people that didn't live there, which meant that any profits that were generated by the vast timber and coal resources that were there were mostly trucked out of the region. I mean, coal had its booms and its busts. I got to experience a little bit of that boom in the early 80s when my daddy was working for the coal company, and then immediately experienced the bust when it went down again and he lost his job. But the fact of the matter is, for as rich of a region as we are, resource-wise, we should have the best roads, the best schools, the best hospitals, the best internet, and it's not the case. And we have to look at policy, we have to look at tax law, we have to look at systemic economic injustice that has contributed heavily to some of the problems that we have in Appalachia today. And this is similar all over the world in mineral-rich areas or where extractive industries exist, but where the local residents are living in poverty. So that's a conversation for another day. But to me, it's germane to this discussion of cultural appropriation and cultural strip mining, which is how it feels sometimes to those of us that grew up in Appalachia. So I'm going to leave with one final story that kind of illustrates the very thing I'm talking about. And it happened 6 or 8 months ago when things were just starting to open back up. And I went to this local bluegrass convention type mini festival, I should say, to see one of my friends play. And there were tons of bluegrass bands, and it was right when things started to open up. So Bubby and Sissy had come out from every holler in Eastern Kentucky because it was in Lexington. And, you know, that's kind of a music hub, one of the music hubs for Eastern Kentucky. People will drive over here to see concerts. So Eastern Kentucky was well represented. And, you know, the energy was high. Everybody was cheering. And I was really enjoying the concert. And I met this girl who was there visiting a friend. And she had flown in from California to see the show. And she was very nice. I chatted to her and I found out that she was in a bluegrassy, old-timey, I'm not really sure, band back in California where she was from. And she was chatting to me and I think she kind of felt like I was a kindred spirit. But she was kind of making these little comments because, you know, it was the crowd. You could tell by the t-shirts and just by the vibe that they weren't all like bleeding heart, tree-hugging liberals. There were a variety of political perspectives represented. Let's just say it was socio-politically a pretty diverse crowd. And you know, that's those of us that play Appalachian music and traditional music in Kentucky, in the South, in the Bible Belt, in Appalachia, we're used to that. You know, festivals, it's always like this kind of crazy mix of, you know, pot smoking, tie dye wearing, dreadlock, you know, people that just love the old time music, and more straight laced, more conservative, more religiously or politically conservative people that are from Kentucky too, or from Appalachia, or from wherever, who just also love the music. So that's the kind of vibe that was at this bluegrass festival. And as I'm talking to this woman, I could tell she was feeling kind of like, oh God, what are all these people doing here? She was feeling some distaste for it, but it was literally the culture and the people that was the origin, the origination point of the music that she loved and played back home. But I got the impression just from talking to her that when she did these festivals and so forth back in California, she didn't have to deal with all of the spectrum of perspectives and viewpoints and, you know, where people stood on maybe masks and vaccines and so forth. So maybe there was more of a bluegrass bubble, if you will, where she was from. But I just thought that was interesting because, you know, it was clearly she loved our music enough to perform it as one of the ways that she made her living. But she wasn't very comfortable with the culture and the people in actuality. And to me, that's kind of one facet of what I'm talking about. So anyway, I hope we can all continue to make music and dance together with respect and harmony. I'm saying these things to people that aren't from Appalachia, but I am on the same journey myself. In my ensemble Cornbread and Tortillas, I perform with artists from different parts of Latin America, as well as a Mexican-American woman. And I've had to just shut up and listen and get the perspectives of the artists that I'm working with on what it is okay for me to perform with them, what they don't feel comfortable with, what they feel like is appropriation, what feels respectful, what doesn't feel respectful. And I don't always know. It's a learning journey and it's humbling, but it's important for us to do, especially if we have white privilege and especially if we have some of the other types of privilege that exist in our society, that we do the work of listening to each other and learning how each other feels. And it's going to be different on a case-by-case basis because Appalachians are not monolithic, Latinos are not monolithic, African Americans are not monolithic. You know, I can't speak for everybody in my culture, and nobody can do that. But I think these are important conversations to have, and I'm grateful to you all for having them with me. So again, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And I'm just going to leave you with the thought. I know I've played the song on this show before, so I won't play it again. But I do want to mention that my song, Me and the Redbird River, was a song I wrote in the audience while I was listening to one of those bands that I felt like was doing some of those no-no points that I discussed earlier. I wrote the song in a direct response to what I felt like was a misrepresentation of my culture. And so not everybody knows that backstory of it. I always love to hear the backstories of songs. And I will link to the song in the show notes just in case you have not heard that song that I wrote for my grandmother. So I hope you have a fabulous week, and I can't wait to see you next time on What Dreamers Do. This episode of What Dreamers Do is sponsored by the online Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging Academy, the only course of its kind and the most comprehensive step-by-step program available for dancers learning this style. I teach beginning and intermediate students the steps and skills they need to dance to traditional mountain music so that they can be confident, joyful dancers and improvisers. Unlike others who just teach the same handful of steps or who just teach routines, I give you not only a bountiful library of steps, but a framework for understanding how the steps fit together with the music. Learn more about the Academy and get started for free with my video tutorial, The Three Essential Steps for Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging. Visit www.carlagover.com today. It's a holy fight.